Joining us this morning from Washington, D.C. is Dennis Stanford. He's an archaeologist. And let me see if I get your title right, Dennis. You're the director of Paleo-Indian and Paleo-Ecology at the National Museum of Natural History still?
That's correct, Robert.
And you've been,
yes.
You've been doing this for a while.
About 40 years.
40
yeah.
years as an archaeologist?
Yeah.
And how long have you been at the Smithsonian?
40 years.
Really?
Yeah, they hired me for the to run the program. And it's been a wonderful opportunity, and it's taken me all over the world, actually.
And you never felt the need to jump ship?
Ever, never, actually. It's the best job a guy in my profession could have.
All right.
But, yeah.
And you're here for the Paths Across the Pacific Conference, which gets going this evening. 6 o'clock is registration at the Sheetgaquan Nakahiti. There's also registration tomorrow morning, Thursday morning, at 8:30 at Rasmussen Hall. And there'll be a reception at 7 o'clock tonight. And, Dennis, you're going to be speaking. We just figured out, looking at the calendar online at pathsacrossthepacific.org, that you're going to be speaking 7:30 p.m. on Saturday
That's correct,
evening
yes.
at Rasmussen. And before we came on the air, I was asking you what the subject of your presentation was going to be, and you said a little bit of everything. And I think probably of many of this year's PATHS speakers, you probably have a lot on your plate. I sort of want to cut to the chase. I mean, the program is called PATHS Across the Pacific, but you are kind of pioneering an idea that North America was populated by people who came across the Atlantic as well.
That's correct, Robert. But it's not to belittle people coming from Asia and across the Pacific, because America has, I think, always been the mixing bowl that we talk about. People were coming from all directions. And the real key here is we now know that watercraft and the ability to deal with oceans has gone back 40, maybe 60,000 years. And that spread around the world. Real rapidly, I'm sure, because when you look at a boat, things like oceans, lakes, rivers turn into highways instead of barriers. And anybody who is at all capable could do it, and they did. And it's changing our whole view of the peopling of the world, actually, not just the Americas, but the world. And it's really an exciting time because it's changing everything we were taught in college and high school, and it's just absolutely marvelous what we're finding now that we've opened up our mind to this bigger idea.
I think you kind of hit it on the head there, is that so many of us, when we were introduced to anthropology and archaeology, we learned about the Bering Land Bridge, we learned about Clovis Point, spear making or flint napping or whatever, and those ideas, in order to get into our high school texts, they already had to be sort of almost the hidebound principles of the profession, and it has not been a simple matter moving beyond.
Oh, it's
Clovis.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that, Robert. Because when I was a graduate student, that was the tenet. Everybody said that. Everybody thought that. And it made a lot of sense because Native Americans look like Asians. We knew that there was a land bridge from Siberia across to Alaska, and we knew about the opening of the ice free corridor. So it was obvious, and Clovis was the people that we had at that time that were the earliest. So it made sense that Clovis people came across from Asia down the ice free corridor and populated North America and ate all the mammoths. And when I was a graduate student, I came to Alaska back in 1966 to test this hypothesis, because remember, it's just a hypothesis. It was never proven. Good idea. But as it turns out, it was wrong. There was never a Clovis guy ever get to Alaska. So where did they come from? And who were in Alaska? Those are the questions we've been wrestling with for the last 4 or 5 years. And it's really exciting because it's changing the whole view of the peopling of the Americas.
Dennis, this is it's creating waves, I guess, in anthropology, the idea that your idea, Solutrean theory, that Solutrean cultures from Europe, sort of the Iberian Peninsula, might have been the progenitors of Clovis. And there was no land bridge, right?
That's correct.
And that's part of the resistance to the idea in general, is that Solutrean people had to develop fully ocean-going maritime capabilities.
Well, not fully gone. That's pushing a little too far, but a lot of my dissenters like to say that. But in fact, what we have is the technology that we see, both lithic and bone and ivory technology in Europe, and the Clovis is really very, very close, whereas there's no resemblance between the Clovis technology and anything in Asia. So that got me thinking that maybe we ought to look at this in a different point of view. And as it turns out, Europe was, during the last ice age, was basically a polar desert. And where are you going to live if you're in a polar desert? And that's going to be along the seacoast, where it's a little warmer, kind of like here in Sitka, it's a little warmer. And the seals are there. And what do you need if you're living in an ice age? You need fat for a lot of things. Fat gives you the energy you need when you consume it. It's good for fire. It's good for waterproofing. It's good for fuel. You can use fat for everything, and you need it. And the thing that most people don't think about is that there's no big trees. There's no wood in Europe at that time. But there is in North America, in the Carolinas, down in Florida. And lots of trees are getting caught up in the Gulf Current, being swept around, coming around the coast of North America and ending up where? In the Iberian Peninsula, in Iceland, those areas right along there. It gives you fuel. It gives you building material, and these trees are washing up on what we call catcher's beaches. And so driftwood was a real key, and the other key is the animals, the seals, the great auk, all of these great fat-producing animals. And I think these people were hunting the edge of the ice. And they weren't going anywhere. They knew that someplace to the west there were big trees, but they were basically making a living like many of the Eskimos did up until recent times, hunting the seals, camping families out on the ice. And they weren't going anywhere, but they ended up following the seals. And what happens is that the Labrador coast keeps the North Atlantic ice in place longer in the west than it does in the east. So if you manage to get off too far west, you're going to have a lot of trouble getting back to Europe, but you're not going to have any trouble getting to the Grand Banks. And once you get to the Grand Banks, you're in a whole new environmental zone. And this is basically what I think happened. And likely they went back and forth. And we're getting a lot of sites now. We're up to 6 sites, radiocarbon dated sites with artifacts from the Chesapeake Bay area. And some way out, I just got back last week, I was out in the Continental Shelf where we're looking at a site that has a mastodon that was killed and butchered 23,000 years ago by people using a laurel leaf knife as a butchering tool, which is the butchering tool that Solutrean people use. So that's that part of the story.
Well, Dennis, we're out of time.
Oh, that's too bad. I was just getting going.
I know. I felt like I did have you just started here. I don't want to steal all your thunder. I think if you want to hear more, you've got to go hear Dennis speak at Paths Across the Pacific. He's presenting 7:30 p.m. Saturday, August 17th at Rasmussen Hall. He'll be talking about this whole idea of Solutrean theory and the migration of people across the Atlantic into North America.
I'm going to talk about the Pacific, too.
And he's going to talk about the Pacific because you've done extensive work in Alaska, especially early in your career. And you are one of the people who is a Kennewick litigant and hoping to get Kennewick Man. I guess Kennewick Man's fate is currently in the hands of the Army Corps of Engineers and the Burke Museum, but even though he's relatively young by the standards of some of the people we've been talking about, he does have a lot to offer, and he'll be talking about that. A lot to talk about in a fairly short program. And I imagine you're going to be doing other stuff while you're here. It just happens not to be on the calendar I have right in front of me. PathsAcrossThePacific.org is the place to go to find out what the schedule is for this year's conference. Registration is this evening, 6 o'clock at the Shikaquan Nakahiti Community House, also 8:30 a.m. tomorrow at Rasmussen Hall. Dennis Stanford is the director of the Paleo-Indian Paleoecology Program at the National Museum of Natural History, where he's been for the last 40 years. I think that's just amazing. Welcome to Sitka, and thanks for coming in
this
morning, Dennis.
I appreciate it.